Surely he has borne our griefs. The text, as you would probably recognize, comes from Isaiah 53. I am going to speak on Isaiah 53 in due course. If you want to find your way there, I will be looking at the last few verses of chapter 52 and then into chapter 53. But before I do so, I want to make a number of comments about the relationship between sin and the judgment of sin. Surely he has borne our griefs, Christ bearing the judgment of sin for us. If there was a New Testament equivalent, it would be 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24, where it says, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree." But I don't want us to have the idea that it was all automatic. Sometimes we are so anxious to clarify what happened at the cross, to present as clearly as we can that Christ died for sin, that we might get the impression that it was all a bit automatic, just simply transferring sin from us onto Jesus as you transfer a weight from one side of the balance to the other and it's all fixed up. Christ's bearing our sin was not something that was simply theoretical, something like a mathematical equation. It was something that happened because of who he was and the way he lived. But I just want to make four points before we look at Isaiah. Firstly, when we see the crucifixion, when we look at Calvary, we see sin judged and condemned. Judged and condemned at the cross, because there its true nature is exposed. That's the first point I want to make, that there the true nature of sin is exposed. Sin cannot really be fully exposed when a sinner is among his own types. We tend to acquit ourselves fairly well. We move among a circle that is very much like ourselves. We perhaps think we don't do the grotesque things that other people do, and so we pat ourselves on the back because the people with whom we mingle, our own set, more or less follow the same standards as we do. And so sin is often not shown up to be what it really is. It's a little bit like the group that plays tennis, a social club. They play every Saturday afternoon. Some are a little bit better than others, but they have a lot of fun. And within their own set, they give each other a good game, and they're quite content, you might say, satisfied with their form, and probably go home thinking they played a fairly good game today, didn't make too many mistakes. But that's because they're playing just with their own group the whole time. But just supposing somebody who happens to be the Wimbledon champion suddenly lands among them. And then they're shown up to be not nearly as good as they thought. You see, we all look reasonably well within our own group. Now, when Jesus was here, we find that perfect goodness and love comes to abide in human society. And then sin is shown up. And it's shown up ultimately in what they did to this good man. They took him and they killed him. And the sin that was displayed at Calvary was not just the peculiar misdemeanors of a small group of people. It was, in a sense, the sin of mankind in general. We see the human response to goodness when it appears in its midst. So that's the first point, that the sin that is displayed in crucifying Jesus has its nature fully exposed through what the people did. The other side of the coin, which is my second point, is that we also, through the cross, see Jesus' attitude to the intrinsic evil of sin. Jesus' opposition to sin was shown not simply by words. Now, it was shown by words. He announced and he preached and he said enough things during his ministry to show his total opposition to sin. But his strongest statement was not by words. It was by willingly placing himself in sin's path. Here is sin boring down the street like a tank, you might say, and here is one individual standing in its path. And it just mows him down. By placing himself right across the path of sin's progress, he exposed it for what it really is. Here we have in Jesus the holiness of God, the perfection of God, and sin cannot dwell with it. There is no way sin can tolerate this holiness in its presence. Sin has to get rid of it, mow it down. And Jesus received the full opposition of sin simply by placing himself in its path and receiving its full assault. And so he was taken and crucified. So there are two points. One, the nature of sin is exposed on the one hand, and on the other, the attitude of Jesus to sin is made very clear. He is uncompromising to the degree that eventually it has to get him executed. The third point I want to make is that the connection between suffering and sin is made clear when we look at Calvary. Now, we all know that sin produces suffering, but we can't always make the equation that every particular piece of suffering is because of a particular sin that that person did. Sure, sin brings suffering, but it's not always the guilty who suffer. We all know that time and again, innocent bystanders are the ones that suffer through somebody else's wrongdoing. It might be some crazy person that goes berserk and starts shooting around the place, and he happens to kill half a dozen people in the supermarket, or someone standing by the bus stop. Or there's some drunken driver who totally loses control of his car, smashes across, cleans up a few other cars, and leaves a few people dead on the way through. Now, the suffering has come through sin, but the people who suffered aren't in fact the ones who committed the sin. They've suffered for someone else's sin. Now, Jesus was part of this society. He was part of a society where the sins of people affect those round about them, and other people's sins affected him. We see time and again how Jesus was maltreated. He was abused. He was physically assaulted, not because he had done anything wrong, but because other people were sinners, and so he suffered because of their sin. That was the sort of society that he lived in, just as it's the sort of society that we lived in. But the point that we're going to find all these points coming out of Isaiah as you read it through, the point that we find in Isaiah is that he suffered not simply because of other people's sin. We all suffer because of somebody else's sin sometime. And Jesus is part of that society. But he suffered not simply because of other people's sin. He suffered to take away other people's sin. He bore our sin. He carried our griefs. Now, that's an entirely different thing. But it wasn't something mechanical. It was something that happened because Jesus had, first of all, become part of this world. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus became one of us and lived in this sort of society where sin is rampant. And he was so identified with his fellows that ultimately God's judgment on their sin struck him. Not just in the sense that you've picked it up, as I said at the beginning, and transferred something from one side of the balance to the other. Now, that in fact is, you might say, what happened. But it didn't happen simply in a mechanical sense. It happened because Jesus had first of all come and for 30 odd years had tasted what it is to live in this sort of society. His identification was total. Total, even to the point where the judgment on sin eventually fell on him. And that fulfillment was possible because he was no ordinary person. We cannot bear away the consequences of other people's sin because we're all sinners. We are all under the judgment of God. But Jesus was not under the judgment of God. And therefore, he willingly could bear away other people's sin. He could willingly take upon himself other people's sin. He could willingly bear the judgment for their sin. He could willingly place himself in the path of sin to receive its full onslaught, and in so doing, bear its judgment and condemn it forever so that it may have no more power over people, that its penalty might be met. And the fourth of these 4 points that I wanted to make was that there at the cross, we see not the triumph of sin over Jesus, but the triumph of Jesus over sin. The triumph over sin and all its consequences made possible because of what Jesus Christ did. Now we're going to read through this chapter. All I'm going to do is read through, make a few paraphrases and comments as we go along, and leave it at that. And let the word speak for itself. We know, of course, that this is one of the servant songs of Isaiah. All those servant songs had specific meaning in the context in which they were written in Old Testament times, to people and events and circumstances of the day. But we also know that whatever relevance they might have had there, their fulfillment comes in Jesus Christ. This chapter is quoted time and again in the New Testament, and of course it was the chapter that the Ethiopian man was reading, and Philip said, yes, it does in fact refer to Jesus. And we're going to read it in that light this morning. When people see the suffering of Jesus in verse 14 of chapter 52, people are astonished. His appearance is marred beyond human resemblance. They see this person, see the way he's been attacked and brutalized. His form is damaged beyond that of any other person. When people saw this one, they turned away from him. They saw nothing in him. They saw no beauty in him. In fact, if you go into chapter 53, you find, for example, in verse 2, they had no understanding of who this person was. Throughout his life, he had been misunderstood. He grew up just like a young plant and a root out of a dry ground. He was just an ordinary person to them. Insignificant beginnings. You get out there in the west of Queensland somewhere, out beyond Longreach, and you've just got miles and miles and miles of almost treeless, dry, open, semi-desert looking country. A dry ground, and then you see some little plant that grows up there. It's a stubbly little thing. It has to struggle even to get 2 or 3 inches above the ground. Nothing magnificent about it. It's not one of the oaks of Bashan or anything like that. You're not going to see it among all the stately trees of some magnificent garden. It's just a root out of a dry ground. It's nothing much to skite about. Man, who is this person anyway? He's brought up in Nazareth. It's only a little village in the hills. And his parents, his family, they're nothing big around town. He's just the son of a carpenter, really, it seems. He certainly didn't seem to have any show of greatness. I mean, he went to school with us, they said. I mean, he's his brothers and sisters. We used to kick the football around the streets. I mean, he was in our class. We saw him at school, and he used to work. He used to sort of help his father with this, that, and the other thing, and he helped his brothers do something else. We've seen him for the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. I mean, who is this person, they said, that suddenly appears? And now he's the Saviour. He doesn't seem to be the sort of person we were expecting. He hasn't ridden in on some stately white horse clothed in shining armour. Just like a bit of vegetation growing out of a dry land. Nothing significant looking about him at all when you look at his background and origins there in the country areas of Palestine. And he wasn't the sort of person you see on the glossy magazines either, all spruced up, smiling at you on the cover. He didn't have any form or comeliness that we should look upon him, no beauty that we should desire him. He's not the public's idea of our all-American hero. In fact, in verse 3, he was despised and rejected by people. He was a man of sorrows, and grief was his familiar friend. He wasn't the life of the party all the time. He wasn't Mr. Charisma that you see on the TV shows, laughing it up there and carrying on in a fashion designed to project his own image as the Mr. Nice Guy or the one who's with it. In fact, he was despised and rejected. And when people saw his sufferings, they turned away from him, it says in verse 3. They hid their faces. They turned away in disgust. He was despised. Nobody took any notice of him. They esteemed him not, gave him no honour that might have been his due. And when they see him now dying on the cross, they think to themselves, well, he blasphemed, serves him right. He set himself up, and now he can't even save himself. Reckons he was going to knock down the temple and build it again in a few days, and look at him, there he is. I mean, he calls himself the Son of God. Well, if God's his father, well, why doesn't God save him? No, obviously he's got his deserts. He's smitten by God and afflicted. That was the standard belief of the time. If you had some calamity fall upon you like this, well, obviously you were the victim of God's judgment. Fitting result for a person who has offended God. But then, on further consideration, there were some who realized that he hadn't died because of any wrong he had done. He had died rather because of the wrong that others had done. He's borne our griefs. He's carried our sorrows. Sure, we esteemed him smitten by God and afflicted, but on sober consideration, we realize now that he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. We are the ones who've turned away from God, and with his stripes, we are healed. It's through what he has done that we can now be forgiven. He wasn't the one who turned away from God. It says in the next verse, verse 6, that we are the sheep that have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, but the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. It's for us that he has died. God's punishment has fallen upon him. Yes, he is smitten by God, but not because of anything he did, rather because of what we did. It's by his stripes that we are healed. Upon him is the chastisement that makes us whole. We have turned each to our own way, but it's upon him that the Lord has laid our sins. And then you look at those who judged him and those who sent him out in verse 7. Sent him off to be killed. They showed no mercy, they showed no justice, an uncouth bunch, not even the slightest consideration for what was true and right. He's oppressed and he's afflicted, but he doesn't open his mouth. He doesn't take up the cudgels against them. He could defend himself, but no, he doesn't. He's like a lamb led to the slaughter. He's like a sheep that's dumb before its shearers. He opens not his mouth. He just takes it, unjust though it is. The greatest travesty of justice in human terms that you could imagine. Every right in the world to defend himself, to stand for his rights and so on, but no, he doesn't open his mouth. He takes it all, willingly, silently, verse 8, by oppression and judgment, he's now taken away to be crucified. And what about the people of his generation? What about the people in Jerusalem? What about those who knew him, those who had seen his works, those who were familiar with what was going on in Palestine at that time, the people of his own generation? What about them? Well, it says in verse 8, they really couldn't care less. Who among them, it says, even considered what it meant for this one to be cut off out of the land of the living? Who among his generation considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? Here he is, killed, cut off from the land of the living, executed, taken away. That's the end, so it seems. This one, taken out and crucified in a demonstration of the injustice and oppression and inhumanity of mankind. And people, on the whole, couldn't care less. They couldn't care less that this one was being executed. His life was taken away like that. In fact, they made his grave of the wicked. They crucified him there between a couple of thieves. Treated him like a common criminal. Left to die in disgrace on a cross. But that wasn't the end of the day. On that Good Friday, when it got to sundown, he wasn't left to hang there in disgrace. Although they made his grave with the wicked, he was in fact with a rich man in his death. One of his disciples, wasn't a very bold chap, a fellow called Joseph of Arimathea. Not the most courageous of people you might think at times, but he stood up and was counted when the time came. He had a tomb that he'd prepared for himself. A rich man he was, fancy tomb he'd prepared against the day of his own burial. He gave this up for Jesus. So Jesus was taken, and although crucified like a criminal, buried, you might say, like a rich man, in a rich man's tomb. He was with the rich man in his death. And all of this, all of these frightful happenings of that first Good Friday, all of this, though he'd done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. And yet it says in verse 10, it was the will of the Lord to bruise him. That doesn't mean to say that God took a lot of pleasure, that he sat there smiling, rejoicing in seeing his son suffer. Must have broken the heart of God, if I can use that expression. But it had to happen. Jesus says, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" As he's on the cross. He realized that he has to go through with this. Nobody's getting any pleasure out of this. But the will of the Lord must be done. And if sin is to be forgiven, its judgment must be borne. And it can be borne only by Jesus Christ, who undergoes the ultimate penalty, suffering the judgment of sin on the cross. Bearing God's wrath against sin. It was the will of the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. My God, why have you forsaken me? Because he was bearing our sin in his body on the tree. A sacrifice for the removal of sin. But that's not the end, because beyond death is resurrection. And it goes on to say that when he makes himself an offering for sin, he then is going to see his offspring. He's going to prolong his days, and the will of the Lord is going to prosper in his hand. Beyond death is going to be resurrection. And he's going to see that this was not a defeat, but a victory. And out of Christ's death come not a bunch of people who are disillusioned and heading off into a leaderless gloom down the pathway, but just the opposite. A group of people who are turned around, who are given hope, and who lead off into a world of light. Out of death comes life. Out of the crucifixion comes the resurrection. Out of apparent defeat comes victory. And he's going to see the fruit of the travail of his soul, and he'll be satisfied. He'll see that it was all worth it. He'll see, after he's been through this great suffering, he'll see the fruit. He'll see people turned around. He'll see people coming and laying their lives before him, repenting of their sin, crowning Jesus Christ as Lord, and declaring themselves to be his disciples, and they'll go on for him. And a few days later, it starts to happen. They preach there in Jerusalem. Very soon you find that thousands of people become followers of Jesus. And out of Jerusalem it goes into the regions round about, and again thousands of people become followers of Jesus. A few years later it's into Syria, it's into Egypt. A few years later it's into Asia Minor. Next, you hear, it's into Eastern Europe. And so it goes on. Within a matter of only a few decades, it has swept across that region of Western Asia and Eastern Europe and Northern Africa. The triumph of the gospel. He sees the fruit of the travail of his soul and he's satisfied. Because when people have this knowledge of the righteous servant of God, many are accounted righteous. Their sins have been borne by him. And now, because of Christ's righteousness, they are accepted by God as righteous. Because he bears their iniquities. End of verse 11. Therefore, verse 12, God is going to give him the conqueror's reward. The sufferer is now the conqueror, and he receives the conqueror's reward. God says, I'm going to divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. This is what happens, you see, when conquerors overcome their enemies, and they share out the spoil with others. So Jesus shares his victory with those who join themselves to him. Those who come to a knowledge of him, they're justified, declared righteous, and now they share the victory of Jesus. Why? Because, it says at the end of verse 12, because he poured out his soul to death. Because he went all the way, he was numbered with the transgressors. He took the place of the sinner. He even prayed for their forgiveness. He made intercessions for the transgressors. He bore the sin of many. But now he's exalted. Behold, my servant shall prosper. He shall be exalted. He shall be lifted up. He shall be very high. You were startled at the sight of his great suffering. Many were astonished at him because his appearance was marred almost beyond human recognition. You were startled at the sight of his sufferings. You're going to be even more startled at the sight of his glory. He shall startle many nations. Kings are going to shut their mouths because of him. They're going to be struck dumb when they see the glory of this exalted one, this triumphant conqueror. What has not been told them, they shall see. That which they have not heard, they shall understand. This one, more glory than anybody could ever imagine, because he poured out his soul unto death. But now God has exalted him. And at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow, and every tongue is going to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father.